Okay.
Very true.
And we should check out the chain of the narration and the content of the narration, whether we can rely on that or not.
Many thanks, dear Sheikh, for your explanations, and your respected listeners for staying tuned. And we have discussed the reality of the proposal of Imam Ali al-Islam to the daughter of Abu Jahl, and right after that, the anger and wrath of Lady Fatima Zahra from such a proposal. And we discussed that this was not true historically, and there was no reality behind the story. And it was, I mean, the person in the chain of narrators was a fake person, was not a reliable person, and he was known to be a liar. Many thanks again for staying tuned and listening to Qiyan and Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio.
لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن.
Communique. The United States assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis marked one of the most significant acts of terrorism by a state actor in recent history. Today we take a look at the fallout from this escalation and how it has shaped relations and tensions between the United States and Iran. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was killed on January 3, 2020, in an American drone strike near the international airport at Baghdad. He was assassinated alongside Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Sha'bi. Both men played an extremely vital role in the region, the importance of which cannot really be overstated. General Soleimani, or as he's also known, Haj Qasem, was a general in Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps and the commander of the Quds Force. Quds means Jerusalem in Arabic, signifying the goal to liberate the Middle East all the way to Jerusalem from the illegal occupation by Zionist and Western forces. The Quds Force helped to establish Iran as a major force in the region and to defend Iran and its allies in several theaters of combat, fighting against Daesh, the United States, and the Zionist occupation. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was also assassinated in the same drone strike, was deputy commander of the PMU, or Hashd al-Sha'bi, which was formed in 2014, and is comprised of Shia, Sunni, Christians, and Druze militias, all fighting under one banner. Both these men were key players in the axis of resistance and a driving force all across the Middle East. Both the Quds Force and the Hashd al-Sha'bi were hailed across the Middle East by all ethnicities in Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Iraq, Yemen, for helping to coordinate resistance efforts and defend their lands from imperialism. Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played a key role helping to crush Daesh. The irony here is that not only did the United States and its allies give rise to the creation of Daesh, they then claimed to have defeated the problem that they created and killed Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi, who had done the real work. In reality, Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi have done more to fight terrorism which the United States created, than anyone else. But because they also challenged U.S. hegemony, this is their real crime in the eyes of the Americans. And that's why they were killed. So this is why the United States always labels people who subvert their imperialist conquests as so-called terrorists, when actually they are the ones openly perpetrating terror. The United States attempted to justify this assassination by claiming it had intelligence that Haj Qasem was about to endanger American lives. Well, where is this intelligence? Because we've never seen it. Is it the same kind of intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If so, I would hardly put much faith in what U.S. intelligence has to say. They conveniently make up things as they go along in order to suit their foreign policy agenda and have no shame in doing so.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
Moreover, this idea that the United States can preemptively attack countries and murder people is the same doctrine and fabricated defense that they used to justify the war in Iraq, to justify drone strikes, kidnappings, torture, rendition, and even murdering their own citizens in drone strikes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. President Donald Trump both claimed that Qasem Soleimani was a terrorist, with Donald Trump writing on his Twitter that he was hated in the region. Not only is the statement by the U.S. completely baseless and false, it's extremely insulting, actually. You know, after they were martyred, millions of people came out to attend their funerals. Both General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played an extremely important role in helping to crush Daesh in Syria and Iraq. So as a Syrian Christian myself, I'm personally grateful to them for this. They helped to liberate our lands from terrorism and saved countless lives from all backgrounds, including minorities and others that would have been killed at the hands of Daesh. Terrorists that the United States and its allies helped to create in the first place. So this is why after Haj Qasem was martyred, we saw several processions and masses even being held in his honor, recognizing his work. Joining me from Tehran is Dr. Sam Torabi, Director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute. Thanks for joining me, Sam. How are you?
My pleasure.
We saw a really touching interview recently from Haj Qasem's daughter, Zainab Soleimani, where she spoke of how her father, he wasn't just fighting for Iran, but, you know, for all people, for a greater good. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has been the story of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution for 40 years, you know. I mean, the movement that happened with, you know, the Iranian nation and Imam Khomeini as its leader, you know, more than 40 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, was a global movement. It was a movement about, you know, truth versus, those forces in this world who want to oppress people. And the movement in Iran, the Islamic Revolution, the revolutionary movement in Iran, decided to not go that path. And of course, this is based on Islam, the real Islam, the Islam of the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Islam of the school of Ahlul Bayt, which neither, you know, accepts being oppressed nor accepts that one becomes an oppressor. So this is the school that Haj Qasem was living. He was an embodiment of it. He was a manifestation of it. And so when the Islamic Republic, when the state in Iran decided that they're going to, you know, make those strategic decisions that they did, which ended up that those forces then went into Syria, that was part of a larger thing. And the larger thing was what I was, you know, referring to right now, which is that it's not just about, you know, preventing Daesh from taking over Syria or any force that's going to cause havoc in the region, or, you know, some sort of a cynical power play between Iran and its enemies. It was a larger issue. It was, as we say in Farsi and Arabic, haq and batil. You know, that was what the war was about. Those who lived it, who saw it, I'm sure, you know, you can tell us more about this. That war in Syria really showed us the true faces of everybody. It was no longer about the labels, you know, Sunni, Shia, Christian, Muslim, you know, leftist, rightist. You know, everybody had to choose the right, had to choose, you know, haq or batil. And it became very clear very soon who's on the side of haq and who's on the side of batil.
So with the one-year anniversary upon us, the United States is claiming that, you know, Iran is firing rockets at the Green Zone, at the embassy in Baghdad, and saying that they're ready to retaliate against Iran. You know, it seems as though they're preemptively blaming Iran for something that they're going to do.
Well, I mean, all of them, Trump, Biden, you know, Democrats, Republicans, they're delusional. They think that, you know, that the Iraqi people don't have their own will. They think that the Syrian people don't have their own will. They think that, you know, the Lebanese people don't have their own will. They see everything through the lens of Iran. You know, it's a mental problem. I don't know how we can solve it. You know, they can't accept the reality that Iraqis would actually not like to be occupied and would actually resist. They can't fathom that. It doesn't fit into their I don't know what we can call it. You know, the same goes for the Syrian people. The fact that, you know, the Syrian people would resist and not want, you know, crazy fanatic Takfiri Wahhabi, allow them to take over the country, and they would actually rise up and they would defend their own country, you know, with all the problems that might have existed in the system of governance that existed prior to the civil war. Nobody denies that. Nobody says that it was heaven. Nobody says that there weren't issues. But the issue is, you know, what's haq and what's batil. Obviously, you know, people are not going to sit there and just watch their country be ruined. Same goes for the Lebanese people and their resistance to the Zionist occupation of their lands and the continued threat that they face from the Zionists. So these are the problems that we have with the West, with the British, with the French, and now with the Americans as the inheritors of the imperial powers, as the inheritor of the British Empire, and also to a certain extent the French, for those countries that were under French influence. So they just can't, you know, believe that people would have their own agency and decide that they don't want to be occupied and that they might want to resist occupation. And let's not forget, you know, we talk about the American embassy, but it's actually, you know, it's the size of the Vatican. I mean, it's a huge, you know, it's basically the Americans are occupying a major part of Baghdad, which is the capital of a sovereign state. And in many ways, they want to effectively turn it into American soil, which is technically what happens when you have an embassy. It's technically the soil of the country in terms of the laws or in terms of the ability of the country in which that embassy is located to enter into that area. So, you know, it's not a building. It's not a bunch of towers or a bunch of buildings or whatever. It's an entire section of Baghdad, which, you know, is being ripped away from Iraqi sovereignty. And so this is a problem. This is not something that can last in the long run. This is something that, you know, imperial powers do. This is what countries do that want to come and stay for, you know, centuries, which, you know, is again another delusion among the Americans.
Right. So, I mean, America thinks that, oh, Iran fired a few rockets in response and that's it. But they don't even really have someone of the same value or caliber as Haj Qasem on their side.
Well, we have Haj Qasem, what we had with Abu Mahdi. These were exceptional human beings. These were people who worked on themselves. These were people who struggled and who reached a high level of consciousness, who reached a high level of purity in their personal behavior and in their lives. You know, let's not even go there with some of the things that we see. Many cases where, and this is all out in the open, where there is reports of massive corruption, personal and structural, within U.S. military. We have scandals erupting around the world where they are being bribed with, you know, things that I can't even mention on TV right now. And so, you know, these are like admirals and captains and generals and colonels. And these are supposed to be the so-called, you know, whatever army of the United States, the military forces of the United States. These are supposed to be the leaders of, so, you know, whatever mythology they want to create from it. And, you know, for us, we have to even not even put these two on a level where we can compare them. These are I'm talking about Haj Qasem, I'm talking about and of course, you know, the thousands of others who, like them, of their generation, after them. You know, when you enter into that world, it's a world where you have to really purify yourself. it's not something that is going to just go away. It's not something that is going to go away with sanctions. I mean, you know, just think about any other country or society in history having to endure these sanctions would have collapsed, you know, and yet we didn't, and we haven't, and thriving. Yes. Most Iranians don't have to worry about the basic necessities of life. Not only that, but we also have been able to really advance in ways that, you know, we were told the only way you can do that is if you connect yourself to some great power and become their obedient servant, and, you know, they will give you the technology.
Sam, thanks so much for your time and your valuable insight. Really appreciate having you on. Thank you so much. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So after Haj Qasim and Abu Mahdi were martyred, how do you see the future of the axis of resistance?
Well, you know, this is another thing that's a Western problem, which is that their system of commanding and their system of leading is you have some heroic figure, you know, leading a bunch of sheep. And so if you get rid of that heroic leader, the sheep don't know what to do. But that's not the way it works. Here, the way it works is the whole movement that Imam Khomeini led is you have human beings being developed. So it's not that Haj Qasim was this person who is irreplaceable. Yes, he is irreplaceable to a certain extent in terms of a historic figure. But, you know, it's not like when with him leaving or with Abu Mahdi not being here that things are going to change in any way, shape, or form. We have a system that's trying to actually develop human beings who are multifaceted, who not only look at things in terms of career and in terms of advancing their own personal ambitions, but in terms of building themselves and purifying themselves and self-edification. And so this is the kind of people that we have, you know, conducting the affairs, especially those who are involved in the military, whether it's the guards or whether it's the army or whether it's Basij or any other branch that's working. So it's not going to make any difference because the strategic goal of the Islamic Republic is to expel the Americans from West Asia. It's the stated goal as stated by the Supreme National Security Council, as stated by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. This is the goal, and it doesn't matter if it's Haj Qasim who is commanding certain forces or whether it's others who are commanding it, or it doesn't matter even if it's Ayatollah Khamenei who is the leader or not. These things are not going to change with the coming and going of people. As you may have seen in the way that these Americans talk, they always talk about, well, when Ayatollah Khamenei is gone, we will do this, we will do that. Well, you know, this is exactly the same thing they said when Imam Khomeini was alive. They said, well, when Imam Khomeini goes, we'll do this, we'll do that. So it's this false projection of their own way of doing things, which is you have some heroic figure leading a bunch of people who have no, you know, ability to think for themselves. This is not the way it works here. And so with him or without him, the path continues. The strategic goal, as I mentioned, is the expulsion of America from West Asia. It's going to happen. And, of course, in terms of Israel, it's the establishment of a Palestinian state, of a Palestinian republic, where Christians, Muslims, Jews live as equal citizens of that Palestinian state. It's not about throwing the Jews into the sea, which is the propaganda that the Zionists always, you know, use. When we talk about ending Israel is not about killing Jews, it's not about getting rid of Jews, it's about ending a Zionist apartheid state. Exactly the way you had a apartheid state ending in South Africa, and it's evolving into a different thing. And so these goals are clear. We are not worried about, you know, losing the support of this president or that president. And so, you know, basing whatever we do on whoever is going to call us from some second-tier official from the U.S., you know, ordering us what to do or what not to do. You know, accept Israel and we'll give you, you know, this much money or whatever it was. Even during the time of the Shah, this was the case. It's not about, you know, being closed off to the world. It's about, you know, it's the system that we have in this region. The British called it, and still call it, Arab facade, which is the strategic, economic, and the security matters are determined by the West, and the leadership is Arab facade. This is in their own documents, and so these are the things that we're dealing with. Countries like Iran, countries like Syria, don't fit into that scheme of domination, and so that's why they're threatened. And in the case of Syria, you know, pulled into this tragic war that went on for so many years.
The killing of General Soleimani marked one of the biggest escalations between the United States and Iran in recent history, which is actually saying something given how many provocations the U.S. has committed vis-a-vis Iran just in the last 2 years alone. Many speculated that his slaying would ignite an all-out conflict. But one can argue that given the magnitude of this transgression, that Iran has actually shown unbelievable restraint. Just ask yourself for 1 second, if Iran had assassinated an American general, wouldn't America have declared war in response? Once again, we see this imperialist double standard where it's okay for the U.S. to violate international laws and commit terrorism while pointing the finger at others. Iran has maintained that its real response in order to properly avenge General Soleimani has not come yet and that they are saving this for a later date. Now, 2 days after the assassination, back in January, the Iraqi parliament unanimously passed a bill demanding the expulsion of all American troops from their soil. After all, this was not just an act of aggression towards Iran, but also a violation of Iraq's sovereignty as it took place on their soil. The United States has been illegally occupying Iraq ever since its invasion in 2003 over weapons of mass destruction that were never found. And of course, the U.S. ignored this new measure by Iraqi lawmakers and has still not left Iraq. A few days later after the assassination, Iran fired a barrage of rockets at the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq, which belongs to the illegal U.S. occupation forces. No one was killed in this attack, but the U.S. hilariously claimed that 110 of its personnel had received, quote, traumatic brain injuries from this attack. Again, one cannot really consider this a true response to the assassination of General Soleimani, as the U.S. military does not even have anyone who is really comparable or of the same value to Haj Qasem, no less a bunch of regular service members, as they call them. Nonetheless, in another significant move, Iran said it would no longer abide by the limitations of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or Iran Nuclear Deal, as it's also called. Iran said it would continue to cooperate with international monitors, but would abandon the constraints on the number of centrifuges it's allowed to have. This marked the fifth step in Iran reducing its commitment to the deal. After Trump unilaterally pulled out of it in May 2018, and then also slapped Iran with crippling sanctions, and also proceeded to order this assassination, which is frankly tantamount to a declaration of war. In the days following the killing, the U.S. Congress introduced the Iran War Powers Resolution in order to try and limit Trump's ability to use military force against Iran. It passed both the Democrat-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, only to be vetoed by Trump himself. In order to justify this act of terrorism, the Trump regime pointed not only to the U.S. Constitution, but also to the 2002 authorization of use of military force against Iraq. These arguments are farcical either way. Just because the U.S. Congress votes to attack another country, that doesn't mean that it is okay or legally acceptable. Even if both houses of Congress wanted to limit Trump's powers in this regard, it's still not up to the United States to unilaterally decide that it can attack other nations. U.S. law does not supersede the U.N. Charter, nor international conventions. This is absurd. It's ridiculous. And it's actually very typical of American exceptionalism. Agnes Callamard, who's the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, condemned the assassination of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi. She said the attack was an unlawful killing and concluded that the United States had violated the United Nations Charter. Speaking about a memo that the Trump regime gave to the U.S. Congress, she said information that Trump administration officials provided was remarkably vague and inconsequential as far as a possible imminent threat is concerned. Even at the most basic level, the U.S. did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary.
The targeted killing of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani, concluding that his was a violation of the UN Charter governing the use of force and an arbitrary killing. On January 3rd, 2020, the world moved into a very different space. On that day, the United States used unarmed drones to target and kill Iran's top general, Qassem Soleimani, as well as a number of his companions, including largely Iraqi representatives. That is a significant and troubling new development. It is the first known incident in which a state invokes self-defense as justification for an attack against a government official outside a declared armed conflict.
Recently, in the lead-up to the anniversary of the assassination, Washington has said it is moving personnel out of positions inside Iraq for fear of, quote, retaliation from Iran. The head of U.S. Central Command, Kenneth McKenzie, said the U.S. is prepared to react if Iran tries to avenge Soleimani's death. Once again, this is a hypocritical, ridiculous point because the United States committed the original act of aggression, but it pretends that it is somehow the victim. Donald Trump also claimed on his Twitter that Iranian-made rockets had been fired at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, which shows that the U.S. is acting nervously and preemptively trying to blame any aggression that it might take on made-up stories. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, his rebuttal included a stark reminder of how the United States lied about the Iraq war, starting wars based on fabrications and doesn't really care about its own citizens. And indeed, if the United States claims to be a nation that promotes democracy and peaceful international relations, it cannot violate the UN Charter and violate international treaties and carry out extrajudicial assassinations. The slaying of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes was not just an act of terrorism, it's a stark reminder of American arrogance and hypocrisy, the real outcome of which we've yet to see. The United States can make up as many false intelligence reports as it likes and lie to its own citizens and the world, but General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi challenged U.S. hegemony, and that is ultimately the real reason that they were martyred. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite clampdown and protests that left dozens wounded, Palestinians say they remain undeterred in their fight to protect their land. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hafifa Fayyad Ryder. This article is titled, Palestinian Bedouins Remain Resilient After Week of Israeli Regime Crackdowns in Negev. Stay tuned for more. Within minutes of crowds arriving at a demonstration in the Negev Desert on Thursday, January 13th, a volley of tear gas canisters, sound grenades, and skunk water fired by Israeli regime police began raining down on Palestinian protesters. Protesters told Middle East Eye what was meant to be a large rally against the Zionist regime's latest land grab in the Negev quickly descended into mayhem. They want to deter us from protesting again, Rafat Awaisha, a Palestinian activist from Negev, told MEE. They want to displace us from our villages to plant housing projects elsewhere. Awaisha added, "We want full recognition of our villages. We want recognition of our ownership before any other services." The protest was organized by the local council of Palestinians living in the Negev in response to the Zionist regime's bulldozers storming the villages of Al-Atrash Sawa earlier in the week. Palestinians from the Negev and the rest of the 48 Palestinian community, those who live within the borders of the occupied Palestinian territories, founded in 1948, amassed near the Al-Atrash Sawa intersection on Route 31 to denounce the resumption of tree planting work by the Jewish National Fund, JNF. Earlier this week, police guarded JNF tractors stormed the village of Al-Atrash Sawa for a third consecutive day to plant trees as part of a controversial forestation scheme. Negev residents say the program, which is carried out on land Palestinian Bedouins live on and use for cultivation, is the latest attempt of a decades-long government policy aimed at displacing them. They want to impose a new reality on the ground, Awaisha told MEE, adding, but people here don't want anyone taking their ownership of this land from them. The recent rally, which organizers say they had obtained permission from the police to organize, was violently dispersed by the Zionist regime's police before it could begin. A large number of the Zionist regime's special forces, mounted police, and a unit of elite undercover agents known as Mustabrin were positioned around the protest as chanting crowds began to arrive at 15 local time. Police had warned protesters via megaphone that they would disperse the protest within 10 minutes, but demonstrators told MEE that before children and the elderly could leave, police started firing sound bombs, rubber bullets, and tear gas. Awaisha told MEE, "I was on the front lines. It took only 20 seconds after the announcement for them to fire the first sound bomb." He added, "It was a frantic attack on everyone present." In the chaos that ensued, a man next to Awaisha was reportedly shot in the head with a rubber bullet. According to eyewitnesses, he was among dozens that were injured. Another protester, identified as Taleb al-Sawaida, 39, was critically wounded and remains in intensive care at Soroka Medical Center in the city of Be'er Sheva, known to Palestinians as Be'er al-Sabah. The Adala Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights, a Haifa-based advocacy group focusing on the rights of Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories, condemned the illegal means used during the police repression in a letter submitted to the Attorney General and the Inspector General of Police. The letter said, "The law is clear. It is forbidden to use rubber bullets, rubber-coated steel bullets, grenades, and tear gas against defenseless demonstrators, and it is forbidden to shoot them from close range and targeting the upper part of the body." after the initial crackdown, the demonstrators were reportedly forced to retreat, and a cat-and-mouse game began with the police that lasted for at least 5 hours. Police also deployed skunk water and tear gas drones. Protest dispersal methods rarely seen in the Negev. Excessive violence was used, posing a threat to the lives of demonstrators, which constitutes a serious violation to individual and collective rights, Adala said in his letter. Despite the crackdown, protesters said the feeling that prevailed at the end of the day was a sense of growing resilience, pride, and hope that the plight of Palestinians in the Negev was getting some attention. Hend Salman, a local activist from the Negev, told MEE that what she witnessed was a glorious day. The protests were led by young men and women, some as young as 16 years old. A campaign to raise awareness about the plight of Bedouins in the Negev was trending on Palestinian social media under the hashtag #Save_Negev as protesters faced off with the police. Salman said there is a young generation breaking into the scene. They understand very well that they are up against and they have no fear. Some calm has been restored in Al-Atrash Sawa village after the JNF said on Wednesday, January 12th, that for now its tractors had ended their work in the village. But the troubles have now moved to the courts, as volunteer Palestinian lawyers scrambled to defend the detained protesters. Since Monday, January 10th, at least 130 Palestinians have been arrested, including several minors. The majority are still detained. The high volume of arrests, which have continued into Friday, January 14th, has overwhelmed the 10 Palestinian lawyers from the Negev, who volunteered to represent the protesters as an act of solidarity with the families. Backup help came from 5 Palestinian lawyers from northern areas of the country, which was appreciated by the Negev residents, according to Awaisha, who was present in court. In and out of the courtrooms, lawyers spent their full days attending to cases and arguing for clients from as early as 7 a.m. and until as late as 1 a.m. local time. The toll of the arrest and the violence seen has been heavy, Awaisha said, but it has not broken the spirit of the protesters. Awaisha said families are understandably worried about their children. They are in a war against land theft, but people remain steadfast.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program we discuss problems, issues and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are mostly based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and naturally of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend, an Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, we'll be continuing our discussion on how to raise teenagers in an Islamic fashion. We said last time that we should know when we want to teach them something, educate them, or maybe even discipline them, that we should do so in a spontaneous manner. It should not be too overly scripted so as to bore them, but should be done in a natural and conversational manner. In addition to that, we also said that when speaking to them, we should employ pathos and logos, both emotion and logic, because only through a mix of both can we actually reach and get our point across to our teenage children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan al-la'in ar-rajim, bismillah ar-rahman ar-rahim, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammadin wa ajjal farajuh. Because we said it is a sensitive time for children crossing into teenage years, so as parents, the way we approach our kids, the way we speak to our kids, the way that we deal with our kids obviously has to change as well.
Right.
As far as they're going through a phase of change, they themselves, me and you, we have to go through that phase with them as well.
Right.
One of the things that most parents don't seem to do is to educate their kids about that period itself, being an adult or hitting puberty.
Right.
Where the child, as he turns into a mature, Islamically mature, reaches the age of maturity, he can see changes in his body, he can see changes in his behavior, he can see changes in his mentality, in his emotions towards things around him.
Right.
And 99% of the times, he has no idea what's happening, right? So he's just an explorer.
And an explorer trying to blend in, I might add.
Well, not blend in, but he's trying to pretty much find out what's going on, where am I? He's like Indiana Jones in the middle of a pyramid.
So I don't know, I'm just confused a lot. I was trying to go with the flow.
Yeah, so he's in a maze, right? And a lot of parents, sadly, they don't explain that period to their kids. Obviously, I don't know, either out of fear, out of embarrassment, out of ignorance. I don't know. How neglect, like you said. I mean, neglect is ignorance.
Because they're grown up, they're adults now. They should know a lot of things suddenly.
Yeah, so in a way or another, it is quite sad to see that happen. So first and foremost, we need to educate them about this period.
And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to raise our teenagers in an Islamic fashion. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
We are at a stage where we said we need to explain to our kids the period they are in. And in this period that the kids go in, especially through puberty, they need to understand their halal and their haram.
Of course.
Which is also a sensitive issue. Most kids go through a lot of emotional problems and emotional issues or things they bury inside, and they don't expect the parents to understand.
Of course.
Okay? And they have needs that needs to be explained to them as well. They need to be put in the direction.
right.
Amongst of which their sexuality, which goes haywire at this age.
It is absolutely a monster. You cannot even tame it. Some say you can tame it, but...
So Islam, obviously Islam has a solution for it.
Right, yeah.
But the idea is that the parents need to put the child in the right mindset. Most people, for example, who grow old without being married or not wanting to get married is because at this age, they were not taught the proper ideology and the proper
the way to approach this matter as well.
Yeah, so what they learn is they learn what they see on TV, what they see on the media. That,
from the culture they live in.
Just have a girlfriend, for example, or a boyfriend, and that's it. Why get married?
It's very normal to have this thought. Very, very normal. Yeah, it's very prevalent among teenagers.
Exactly. So unless we sit them down, we explain to them how this period works and how to navigate it and how to get through it and how to manage it and give them that guidance ourselves, it will be, you know, a problem because they will be rebellious, they will be constantly arguing, they would never do what you want them to do, and, you know, they will be, you know, wasting time most of the time and they have nothing else to do. So I've heard so many complaints from parents about their kids. And when I ask them the basic questions about whether they have any sort of interaction or they explain things to them, they're like, no, we haven't. And then they're like, okay, then you should come and talk to them. I'm like, no, I can help from here and there.
But I can guide.
But ultimately, it's your job as a parent to explain this to your kids because, you know, he takes you as an authority, not me.
Right, yeah.
So, for example, if I have to talk to him about marriage, I mean, at the end of the day, I might convince him that marriage for him at a younger age is the excellent thing for him to do, which I always do with teenagers. I convince them that marriage is the best thing, and they're like, that's exactly what I was thinking. But it's like, but say it, my parents would never agree.
And that's the problem.
So they constantly, so the parent needs to come themselves.
They need to educate themselves firstly.
Yeah, and, you know, say to their kids, okay, this is what you're going through. This is the halal way. This is the haram way. This is what has to be done, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Otherwise, we're going to have
because this is a problem. I might say toxic, but at least it is a very sensitive subject. And it is often not spoken about in our communities at all.
Well, I mean, it's not toxic.
Well, not toxic in that manner, but it can spiral in a,
Now, look, there are matters in life where we need to face head to head.
Right.
But it's the approach that makes a difference.
Right.
Okay, so some people approach it differently, like in the wrong manner, and some people approach it correctly. So
it's a volatile subject. There we have it. Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, so you need to obviously approach it correctly.
Right, right. And with that said, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are talking about how to raise our teenagers in an Islamic manner. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us even further.
Now, we also have to keep in mind that when we are dealing with teenagers, that we need to teach them not only about the period they're in, but also prepare them for it. They have to be prepared for what's to come and explain, like I said, things to them. So we need to teach them to think and contemplate and think of consequences. Because at this age, they haven't had a prior experience in life.
So this is a general rule, not just about Islamic laws?
No, it's just general rule. I mean, all these general rules that we have, obviously, is derived from Islam.
Right,
so, for example, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, إِذَا حَلَمْتَ أَدِي أَمْرٍ فَتَدَبَّرْ عَقِبَتَهُ.
Right,
if you want to do something, if كان خَيْرًا فَأَقْدِمْ. The Quran was good. About contemplation. Do it. If not, don't. Right. So there is, you know, so this is all Islamic teachings basically, right. But we're just putting it in simple words. So we need to teach the kid to think and contemplate before he does any action or before they act. Okay, because this at this stage, like I said, they themselves do not have prior experience.
Right. No life experience.
So they have no experience at all. They don't know what to do when certain things happen.
Of course.
And now it's me, it's my job, a new job to teach them.
Right.
Make them think for themselves. Right. Make them more, you know, they use their insight and use their intellect and be able to contemplate on things themselves.
It's basically a rule of life.
Yeah, so it's not, even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, when you see in the Quran, when he constantly talks about the stories of other nations or the Aqwam before us.
Right.
Well, obviously, he's not trying to entertain me and you with this story.
No.
I mean, some of them
not
are
just
quite
a story time.
Yes, some of them are quite entertaining in their nature, but the idea was that Allah is trying to teach you something that you should learn
contemplate.
From the people who were before you, what they did and the consequences.
Reflect upon
that
their actions.
And you should not do the same at all.
Right.
Same thing with our kids. So you sit them down. I've seen this happen many times with parents. They bore their kids to death.
Like,
when I was your age, I had this and I done this.
To be fair, some stories can be very interesting. But
No, the story is one thing, but if you're using it as a method of trying to teach your child, just by reflecting on your past and that's it. I mean, I've heard many times the kids, we've heard this so many times, my dad always said this. He always says, when I was young, I did this. I heard this from my dad all the time. I'm like, when I was at this age, I used to read this bunch book, and then I used to be like, oh, yeah, sure, because you had no TV.
Right.
You had nothing else to do.
It was always,
So that's not the way to get them to think and contemplate and think of their consequences. So we have to train them, basically, into the correct right method of thinking, the correct and right method of having an insight into things, and the correct method of trying to contemplate on matters. For example, I sometimes when I talk to kids, I throw in a line or two and I leave it unanswerable, and they're like, okay, so I'm like, what do you think?
Right.
So he automatically starts to
Engage the thinking.
So he has to do the thinking for himself. So this is what we need to do as well.
Right, and with that, we will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any comments or questions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. In addition to that, we also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.